This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Welcome to our Friday Pitch-In, where we split up the hour to focus on a few different Indiana-related topics. Coming up, a new study out of Notre Dame wanted to see what habits or activities increased concern for the natural world, or so-called ecological empathy. And the new young adult novel, You Should See Me in a Crown, is set in the fictional town of Campbell, Indiana, and it confronts racism, sexuality, and navigating high school while staying joyful and positive. We'll talk to the Central Indiana native who wrote the book. But first, a look at the week's biggest headlines with Indiana Public Broadcasting's digital producer, Lauren Chapman. Hi, Lauren.
Hey, Matt. How's it going?
Not too bad. So what was in the news this week? A lot.
Yeah, this is a long week. So
it certainly has felt like one.
Yeah, right. We can go ahead and start by the numbers for COVID-19 news. As of noon today, 2,327 people have died from COVID-19. That's up from 2,214 last week. There are nearly 42,000 confirmed cases and more than 392,000 Hoosiers have been tested. Comparing to last week, that's up from 39,000 confirmed cases and more than 335,000 Hoosiers who had been tested. And just as a reminder, speaking of testing, I did a story last Friday, I think, is what my brain is telling me, that anyone who wants to get tested may do so now at OptumServe testing sites. These are the sites that are in partnership with the state government, with the Indiana state government. By going to coronavirus.in.gov, you can find a site that is closest to you and sign up. So anyone who lives or works in the state of Indiana may get tested if they have concerns.
And I just checked, that was last week, so good on you for remembering.
Perfect.
And we also took a look this week with an all-in episode that aired yesterday from a Facebook Live that aired on Wednesday night. Mm-hmm. Oof, I'm getting dizzy. We talked about party conventions, and we've got some news from the Democratic convention. What do we know?
Yeah. Former Evansville Mayor Jonathan Weinzapfel is the Indiana Democrats nominee for attorney general. He was a former state lawmaker and Ivy Tech chancellor and won by just 48 votes out of more than 2,000 cast by state party convention delegates, narrowly beating State Senator Karen Tallien, who represents Ogden Dunes. In accepting the nomination Wednesday evening, he laid out his vision for the general election, and it's clear that COVID-19 will be a huge theme for him. But he also says his campaign will not rely on Curtis Hill being the GOP's nominee, which takes us to yesterday. The GOP convention officially started last night, and the four candidates vying for the Republican nomination for attorney general made pitches to state party delegates in a virtual convention broadcast. The in-person convention was canceled, of course, because of COVID-19. Same for the Democrats. The two frontrunners for the attorney general nomination, former Congressman and Secretary of State Todd Rokita and incumbent Curtis Hill, didn't shy away from talking about the sexual misconduct charges that have been that have put Hill's candidacy at risk. Curtis Hill's 30-day suspension from the Indiana Supreme Court for battering for criminally battering four women ended on Tuesday. The governor asked for clarification if it meant that Hill wasn't eligible to be attorney general, but the Indiana Supreme Court declined to answer that question. And Todd Rokita jumped into the AG race late in the game, just barely a month ago. He's been a figure in Indiana politics for the last 20 years, first serving as the Indiana Secretary of State for 8 years, and then as a U.S. representative until he ran for U.S. Senate in 2018 and lost to now U.S. Senator Mike Braun. So those are the two big candidates for the GOP. When we will find out who becomes the attorney general nominee for the GOP will be a real hot minute. Republicans have not sent out their ballots or sent out their ballots today, something along those lines, will be or have been sending out their ballots after those speeches happened. So it may take up to a few weeks before we find out who ends up being the GOP attorney general candidate for November.
And as we said on yesterday's show, name recognition does count for a lot in this case. Of course, you've got Todd Rokita and Curtis Hill at the top, but also Decatur County Prosecutor Nate Harder and Indianapolis Attorney John Westerkamp are mm-hmm. in that mix as well for the nomination for the GOP Attorney General seat. Well, the job, I suppose. Let's look at, well, do we know anything else about the GOP convention? It began yesterday. Mm-hmm. Is it a one-day thing?
You know, I should know that answer, but I genuinely don't. I think
because with the virtual element, it's really, really changing things an awful lot. Mm-hmm. And so looking at all of those variables is can get a little dizzying. Let's move on to the anniversary of Eric Logan's death, the man who was killed in South Bend a year ago, as it relates also to Drayshawn Reed and the wrongful death lawsuit that's taking place here in Indianapolis. What do we know?
Yeah, so both of those cases, one in South Bend, one in Indianapolis, had some movement or recognition this week. So Drayshawn Reed, the family of Drayshawn Reed, filed a wrongful death lawsuit on June 16th on what would have been his 22nd birthday. The suit claims lack of training and the use of excessive force that led to his death. And it also details how Reed, you know, fled from police on May 6th in a friend's car before stopping at 62nd in Michigan. Police have said that Reed fired a gun at one of the officers, but the family disputes that claim. And so last week, a special prosecutor overseeing the case asked the Indiana State Police to handle the investigation, saying it was best for an independent agency to look into the shooting. The Reed family has asked for an investigation by federal authorities, and attorneys representing the family say they don't trust the city to handle the investigation properly. So that all happened this week. And then what also happened this week was the one-year anniversary of the shooting death of Eric Logan in South Bend. Some of Logan's family and close friends held a memorial service that night and on Tuesday night and marched to demand justice 1 year after his death. They marched to the apartments where he was shot and killed by a police officer. Many of the protesters who gathered said the changes made in Minneapolis and Louisville highlight exactly how slowly South Bend has been to adopt the changes that they want. While the officer who killed Eric Logan, Ryan O'Neill, is no longer on the police force, the special prosecutor declared the shooting was justified after an investigation, so he never faced any sort of criminal charges. And activists and protesters say that's still not fair and that they want to continue to see changes made to the South Bend Police Department.
Sobering anniversary, to be sure, and we will keep an eye on what's happening in South Bend as it relates to the anniversary of the death of Eric Logan, of course. Let's move on to what we heard this week, a promise from the governor that K through 12 education will not see any cuts despite a big budget shortfall. What do we know about that?
Yeah, so the Governor Eric Holcomb asked state agencies to cut their budgets by 15% and colleges and universities by 7%. But Holcomb says after asking state leaders to find cuts elsewhere, funding for K through 12 schools will follow the state's current budget levels. School leaders have expressed many concerns about the funding cuts, especially in light of a 2019 law that limits how much they receive for students who learn virtually more than 50% of the time. State guidance encourages schools to enhance virtual learning opportunity or options if parents decide to keep their kids at home from school, or in case of a new surge of COVID-19 outbreaks causes some schools to close again in the fall. The Indiana Department of Education recommended state leaders allow schools access the full amount of funding for students who would otherwise be in the classroom. And Republican budget writers, Senator Ryan Mishler from Bremen and Representative Tim Brown from Crawfordsville, both say they support the idea of fully funding students virtually during the pandemic and would back legislative action to do so. So right now, it looks like things are pretty copacetic for K through 12 funding right now, especially in light Of the other big news that we learned this week, Indiana fiscal officials expect the state to fall between $3 and $4 billion short of its current two-year state budget. A new revenue forecast will come out later this year, but officials at the state budget committee meeting on Wednesday say they expect a $1.7 billion shortfall for this fiscal year, which ends in about 2 weeks, and another roughly $2 billion lost next fiscal year. So the existing state budget reserves should be able to cover the full budget shortfall for this fiscal year, but remaining reserves would only meet about half the budget shortfall for the following year. So the state has asked its agencies to make those cuts, and together those cuts could reach about $1 billion.
Good to be a state that's in the black, I suppose. It would be an awful lot worse if we weren't. And next year, of course, is a budget year for the Indiana General Assembly, and it will be interesting to see what ends up happening where that is concerned. Thanks for bringing us up to speed on that. And we also conducted Wednesday night's Facebook Live with the help of the Indiana 2022 Way. What do we know? How can we sign up for the Indiana 2022 Way?
Super easy. Just text the word elections to 73224. Every Thursday, we send you a question or just stories that we have reported because of feedback that we've gotten from the group. And that helps us kind of direct where we are focusing our attention. There's so much happening all the time. So it's really helpful to have an idea of what folks need and want to hear, especially as we roll up to an election, as we continue to cover the coronavirus, as we continue to try and navigate this wacky world right now. So elections to 73224.
And if you missed yesterday's show that was based on that Facebook Live event that we did on Wednesday night, you can find that in our podcast feed. We actually had a lot of fun talking about party conventions and got to some great questions from the Indiana 2022 Way. Again, if you want to sign up for that, you can text elections to 73224. She is our everything, but officially she's our digital producer for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Lauren Chapman, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Up next, to simply turning off lights when you leave a room and not using water, more water than you need to, or recycling all those cans. Do those things make you more aware of the natural world, or does being among it, spending time outdoors or watching a bird feeder do a better job? We'll look at a study out of Notre Dame with some interesting findings about what increases our ecological awareness and empathy. That's next. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. We often hear about the importance of sustainability practices like reducing energy consumption, recycling, or lowering our overall carbon footprint. Those of us who do those things may cite a number of reasons why, but a new study out of Notre Dame wanted to look at whether simply participating in those conservation practices had similar effects as actually communing with nature, watching or being among it. Darsha Narvaez is professor of psychology emerita at the University of Notre Dame and one of the authors of this study, which made it into the June edition of the journal Ecopsychology. Dr. Narvaez, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
First of all, I always grapple with how to reduce a study to just a few lines. I mean, things are always more complicated when you're the one closest to it. I mean, does that intro about sum things up?
Well, our aim was a little bit shifted. So we wanted to know whether we could help people adopt a kind of a communal orientation to nature, what we call indigenous worldview, and whether practicing for 3 weeks of doing things related to that would actually affect their sense of attachment to nature, ecological attachment. So the focus was more on that, and we contrasted it with conservation behaviors, as you mentioned.
And so what made you want to look at this?
Well, it turns out that people have been talking about the importance of caring for the natural world for decades and how we're destroying it in various ways. And people know that intellectually that we should be doing something. And, yeah, they do something around the edges, the margins, but it doesn't really change people's orientation in their daily life to the extent needed, or even the corporate world, et cetera. And so Wendell Berry and others have said it all turns on attachment, on affection. You have to feel connected and feel like you are responsible for, that you are related to the natural world. And we were trying to then get students, undergraduate college students, to kind of get into that mindset, which really reflects the indigenous worldview, what First Nations peoples around the world, how they're oriented to the natural world.
But when we look at this over the course of human history, I don't know, do we see this connection to nature as something that we've largely lost, or is it one that's just harder to make now?
It's actually something we've lost. I've been reading recently Carolyn Merchant's book, The Death of Nature, and she documents the history of how it shifted in Europe in the last hundreds of years. Before the 17th century, for example, people really did feel connected to the trees and the forests and their land and the animals, and maybe not as deeply as First Nations peoples, but they did feel that. And there was some rules about, you know, not killing animals in any disrespectful way. And we've really lost that. Capitalism came in, and the Enlightenment philosophy of kind of dualism, we call it, of separating humans from nature, of soul from body, all these splitting of the kind of the way we look at the world. And that's contributed. It's complicated.
Sure. I'm sure that it is. Yeah. Well, I mean, is it just the advancement of society? Is it just the introduction of technology? Is it just the Enlightenment that got us there? Or is there a lot more at work?
I think there's a lot more at work. We know from, I study early childhood development and its effect on social skills, worldview, morality, well-being as well. And those early experiences really matter for how you see the world. So if you are not immersed in nature, you don't develop those very implicit kind of subconscious connections and feeling part of the world. For example, if we just stick to the nature connection piece. And so you grow up, we raise kids inside walls most of the time and in front of screens. And so they're missing that real deep sense of being part of the earth that our ancestors always had. So a lot of it has to do with experience. And then they're told, you know, in school to think about things and take tests and not worry about their feelings or the, you know, the bird outside the window of the classroom, whatever it is, you know, and we force people into this kind of detached way of looking at the natural world.
So for this study, you compared two conditions. Can you break those down?
Sure. So we had the condition we called ecological attachment. We wanted them to practice actually thinking about the natural world, to feel embodied connection to the trees they walk by every day, or noticing the sky or the clouds, different activities each day. And the other condition was we called conservation, where they practice things like turning off the lights when they left a room, turning off the water when you're brushing your teeth, recycling, avoiding using plastic, that kind of thing. And so what happened is they were randomly assigned, or college students, randomly assigned to a condition when they came into the laboratory. They took a pretest on their orientation, their what we called ecological empathy, how much feeling they have for different aspects of the natural world, their mindfulness about their actions towards the natural world, and then their green action, we called it. So how much they did conservation kinds of activities. So they took a pretest, then they each got a set of readings related to their condition, a poem, an essay, and facts about how important whatever their condition was. And then they got to select 21 activities from a set for their condition to take with them. And then each day for the next 3 weeks, they were to select one from an envelope and practice that all day long, and then pick a new one the next day. And then they came back for a post-test about 3 weeks later.
And so if we look at more closely at the conservation condition, these are the students who were given the reading materials. Both conditions were given reading materials, but these were the students who were they were just told to I guess participate in conservation practices. What did you find out about them?
Well, they increased then in their from their pretest to their post-test. They reported that they did more of the green actions of paying attention to trying to simplify their life, avoid buying disposable products or excess packaging or things like that.
And so then the other condition, the ecological attachment group, these were students who were also given these tasks that required them to be among nature to varying degrees. What was different about their experience?
So they were asked, they weren't asked to do these conservation activities. Instead, they were asked to think about what they were doing every day in terms of relating to nature. And so the kinds of activities were pay attention to the trees today, greet the trees that you walk by, pay attention to an animal, figure out what phase the moon is in, sit outside for 5 minutes and watch nature, listen to nature for 5 minutes, smell the smells of nature, take a walk around the lake, because this was on Notre Dame's campus, and we have two lakes, so take a walk around the lake today, pay attention to the winds today. So these are all things that just sort of your body is in nature, pay attention kind of orientation.
So do you feel that combining the reading materials with the conservation condition group, not conservation, the ecological attachment group, do you think that those two were essential together, or do you think simply being ecologically attached was enough for them to draw these conclusions?
Well, we used an approach that the Heath and Heath have suggested for changing behavior. So what you do is you direct the rider, the conscious mind. And that's what we did with our readings. We wanted to direct them to the importance of doing whatever their condition was. And then there's three things. The second is to motivate the elephant, the subconscious. And so these are college students. They got extra credit. So that we did kind of cheated on that. For regular people don't get extra credit when they do these things. But there's ways to motivate yourself, you know, with little rewards and things when you change your behavior. And then third, you have to shape the path for the elephant and the rider to follow. And that's where we have all the 21 items they selected over 3 weeks. We also wanted to give them choices, right? So that we just didn't give them the 21 items. They got to pick which ones they want. And it's always good to give students or anybody choices because they feel like they have more control over their life. So we use that kind of method. And we expected both groups to change and grow in the way that we their condition allowed. And so we were very happy to see that they did go in the directions we expected in the post-test. But both groups increased in what we called ecological mindfulness. So that's actually paying attention to their actions in the world, in the natural world, their effects on whether, you know, how impactful they were. So treating animals like my brothers and sisters is one of the items of ecological mindfulness. Showing respect for a plant, recognizing a wild animal around my home, that kind of thing. So we were really happy that both conditions did that.
I mean, and you also looked at or were able to measure what you call ecological empathy. And
yes,
that came from the group, the ecological attachment group.
That's right. They're the only ones that increased in their empathy, where they felt concern for a particular species in the last week, for a plant, for a forest, for a group of animals, for biodiversity in general, for the well-being of the earth. So those are those kinds of items that they did increase on, which we were happy to find.
We are talking to Darshan Narvaez, a professor of psychology emerita at the University of Notre Dame and one of the authors of a study on ecological attachment. And did you hear from any of those subjects in the ecological attachment group about how this study changed their perspective? Would you say that any of them were profoundly affected?
We actually didn't ask for their comments. unfortunately. But I do teach a class where I have asked students to work on their ecological attachment. And so we did have a number of students in my course that we, in the press release, they were quoted. And they have told me, and I've had conversations with each of them where they tell me that they've never really thought about nature as some place to be related to, and having experiences where they were required, actually, you know, they were given this similar list of things to do and where they had to do them for credit, you know, and keep a journal about it. And they found that that really helped them calm down. And when we went into COVID online teaching because of COVID, they found the nature connection activities to be especially helpful to help them get through this really stressful time period. And taking walks and wandering around the neighborhood where they when they lived in places where they could do that, or sitting outside and watching the bird feeder and the birds coming, or planting a garden or things like that. So they were quite happy that they had practiced, and we had practiced ahead in class, face to face, and various ways of self-calming. And then for them to do the nature thing on their own was okay, because you could do that in the COVID shelter in place.
What does this then tell us about how we can maintain, or I guess regain, our balance with nature?
Yes, I think so. My work is about embodied morality and how our experiences of where we place ourselves shapes our intuitions. It shapes our habits. And so it's really important to select those ways, those activities. This is Aristotle. He said you need mentors to guide you in selecting activities and friendships and everything you do, because it is shaping your sensibilities, your understanding, your habits. And then eventually you don't need mentors, and that's usually maybe when you're 40. But I think we all need them all throughout our lives, actually, for various things. So we need to remember that whatever activities we immerse ourselves in are shaping our intuitions, our subconscious mind's assumption about what's normal and what to relate to, what our attention focuses on, what we perceive. And we know this from, you know, people who are novices or experts in an area. A novice just doesn't see what the expert sees, and the expert sees things immediately because they've rehearsed and rehearsed so much and learned to put their attention in the right place. So that's what we wanted to show in this experiment, is that we can actually reshape our attachment to nature, our connection to nature, by the activities we choose. So just taking a walk around the neighborhood and noticing the trees, paying attention, lying back in the grass like we used to do when we were kids, and watching the clouds go by, and earthing on the earth, you know, that's a like sunning, you know, sun is good for you to some degree. And then earthing is lying on the earth barefoot, or there's earthing blankets now, things like that. That also promotes health. These are health, well-being, flourishing activities that help us all and help us then feel connected to being on the earth. We are earth creatures after all, and we need to feel connected so that we don't continue to mindlessly destroy living creatures around us.
Yeah, speaking of the pandemic and what it has done to all of us and how it's changed things, you've also suggested that these ecological attachment practices can also supplement, I guess, our connection to our faith.
Yes. You know that Thomas Aquinas said there were two ways to God. One was through the Bible, and the other way is through nature. And I think we are all, the last few hundred years, the focus has been on all the material world, what you see and what you can measure. That's kind of the Enlightenment science, Enlightenment philosophy. But we're much more than that. There's a lot going on. There's dark matter, you know, can't even see it, but it's most of the universe. There's a lot of stuff we can't see, the unmanifest. And so we all have this spiritual, you call that a spirituality then. There's spirituality in the world. What are we going to tune into? So the natural world gives us a chance to tune into the positive, the it helps promote a feeling of gratitude. When I watch, you know, the animals, there was a hawk in our yard today, and the ravens were trying to get, you know, it to move, and the squirrels were teasing it and all this. But I felt connected, like, oh, that's just part of my community, right? So there's a spirituality we need to enhance and not be so afraid of it, you know, taking over our wisdom or our sciencey mind. We've got all sorts of sides to us. And I think we have to find our own path. Each person has a different path. So how are you going to connect to nature? Is it going to be kayaking down the river? Is it going to be hiking? Is it going to be gardening? Some way you need to connect to the natural world in order to feel care for it, and then to feel the enhancement of your own life, that spiritual kind of connection as well.
Darshan Narvaez is Professor of Psychology Emerita at the University of Notre Dame. Professor Narvaez, thanks for this work and thanks for your time today.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Up next, the new young adult book, You Should See Me in a Crown, is getting a lot of attention for its challenging but positive message, which is highly relevant right now. We'll speak to the author, a Central Indiana native, next. I'm Matt Pelser, back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. There are lots of heavy but necessary conversations about race happening all around us, and for good reason. It's nice when some of those same issues can be presented and grappled with through a good young adult novel. Author Leah Johnson grew up in Central Indiana and recently released You Should See Me in a Crown. Leah, it's great to have you with us, and congratulations on the book.
Matt, thank you so much for having me.
Is this your first novel?
It is. It's my first novel being published, and it's the first novel I've ever completed. A lot of writers have like 12 manuscripts in the drawer that never quite made it off the ground, but this is the only thing that I've ever gotten all the way through. So,
All right. Do you have other things that you've started and stopped and maybe are waiting to complete as well?
I went to grad school. I got my MFA in fiction writing from Sarah Lawrence. And while I was there, I worked on a novel for my thesis. And I got about 80% of the way through that book, but that's the only other project I've started and not completed. Since then, I have another book that I've written that's coming out next year.
Well, what was it about this one that you thought, well, I've got to finish this one. This story needs to be told.
Well, the answer that I'd like to give you is that I was so passionate about this story and my heart was in it, and it was the book of my life, and all of these things are true. But the other side of that is I finished this because we sold this book before it was finished.
Uh-huh.
And so I had to do it. I had to get it done. I had that motivation in the form of a contract pushing me.
That'll do it. So this book takes place in the fictional town of Campbell, Indiana. How much of Campbell is based on where you grew up?
So I'm from the west side of Indianapolis, and my family lives right on the borders of Claremont, Indiana, and Brownsburg, Indiana. So the book is sort of set out here in this area, but it's an amalgamation of a lot of communities that I've lived in over the course of my life, in which there are a lot of white folks, there aren't a lot of out queer people, and there certainly aren't a lot of out queer Black people. And so I was drawing inspiration from a lot of the places that I've lived in over the course of my life.
So is the main character, Liz, an out queer Black woman?
She is. Liz is 17 years old. She's grown up in a small and small-minded town in Indiana called Campbell. And bless her heart, she just wants to get out. She wants to go to college. And that would be difficult enough for someone who has taught themselves or been taught over the course of their life that silence and shrinking yourself is the best way to survive in your community. But Liz also happens to start falling for the new girl who is her competition.
What was it about that setting of Campbell, Indiana, the fictional town? What is it about that setting that's important to the story?
You know, when I began working on this book, when I knew that I wanted to be a fiction writer professionally, I wanted to write into all the empty spaces that I saw in YA growing up. And so for me, there was an absence of narratives about girls who came from communities like mine, who moved through the world in the way that I did growing up. And so I wanted to write back to that 15, 16, 17 year old Leah, and give credence to that experience. And so I wanted to make sure that that life was reflected on the page in a way I'd never seen before. And so they tell you to write what you know. And what I know is cornfields. What I know is being Black in white spaces. What I know is feeling like you don't quite fit and having to figure out how to invent spaces for yourself to feel totally at home. And so when I had the chance to do it, when I got my opportunity to write this book, it only made sense to return to the community that raised me.
Did you experience any racism growing up?
Yeah. So I will say I was really fortunate in a lot of ways to be shielded from the insidiousness of anti-Blackness, because I'm Black. My family is Black. I was raised in the Black church. I had a lot of friends from different backgrounds growing up. But I remember when I was 16 years old, I walked into a dress shop out here with my best friends. We were looking for prom dresses. And we walked in, and most of my friends were white, and they were just running through the store. They were trying stuff on, having the time of our life. It was like a montage in a teen movie. And I remember I went to pick up this white dress that looked a lot like Hilary Duff's dress in the Cinderella story. And the woman who owned the shop, presumably she was an older white woman, she walked over to me and stopped me from picking it up. And she said, I don't think that's the dress you want to try on. And I said, oh, no, it is. I definitely do. And she said, isn't that a little expensive? And I said, well, I'm not really too worried about it. Just want to try it on. And I'm looking at all my friends who are having the time of their life. And we're the only ones in the shop. And my friends have stopped trying on the dresses. And they're watching this interaction now, confused. And I said, well, yeah, if I could just get a dressing room, that'd be really great. And she says, I think you're going to get it dirty.
Wow.
And yeah. And so in that moment, I had a different level of awareness. Like something dawned on me. I was like, wow. Okay. So this isn't just a thing that I've been sensing, but nobody has put a name to. People actively resist my presence in these spaces. And so it's no coincidence that the book deals so heavily with race and racism as it relates specifically to prom.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's so interesting you bring that up because prom is a central theme to the book. And well, I guess we haven't really outlined the plot yet. I want to make sure we get right back to how the book relates to our current moment. But I guess without spoiling anything, of course, what would you say is your back cover synopsis?
Yeah, so I'd say the book is about a girl who wants to get out of her small-minded Midwestern hometown and go to college. But when her financial aid falls through, she runs for prom queen for the scholarship that's attached to the crown. And along the way, it's complicated even further by the fact that she starts to fall for her competition.
And I guess how would you say this book resonates with the Black Lives Matter movement? Would you say that it does?
Yeah, I'd say that there is no better time to engage with Black literature across genres, but specifically contemporary fiction. This book is a book about Black joy. And I think at the heart of any story about Black joy, we're talking about Black liberation. And that's what this fight that's raging on across the country and has been raging for hundreds of years in different ways. That's what it's about. We're interested in walking out into the world without having to fear being on the receiving end of some sort of violence or prejudice, specifically at the hands of the state. And so while this is a book that is incredibly joyous, I hope that folks walk away feeling warm and fuzzy and happy. It doesn't shy away from what it looks like to be Black and queer in environments that do not want you to be Black and or queer in those spaces. And so while Liz is navigating regular high school stuff like best friend drama and trying to figure out what she's going to wear to prom and balancing her part-time job, she's also reckoning with the fact that the people around her, many of the people around her, would feel a lot more comfortable if she was not infiltrating their spaces, if she was not trying to upset the status quo. And so I think this is a really human look at what racism can be when it is subtle and not necessarily the type of racism that we talk about on the news. This is just the everyday insidiousness of microaggressions.
I guess, where would you say those problems, though, microaggressions, fall on the scale of the things you think need to change, like the big things that we hear about on the news? Do microaggressions need to be addressed as well, just as much?
Yeah. So, you know, I think what a lot of us are interested right now in unraveling are major, large scale issues. And there is never going to be a time when those things are not crucial. We need to dismantle the system of policing that we currently have. We need to think really critically about what abolition is going to look like. We need to prison abolition. We need to think really critically about what the justice system does to Black folks. But alongside those things are the impacts of everyday acts of racism. So when you have a coworker in your office who you make sister girl jokes to, and you ask if you can touch her hair, and you cross the street when you see a Black person walking down the sidewalk, those acts of racism are small, but the impact is massive. It spans much further than what it seems like they span, and they are deeply damaging. And so I think folks right now are looking to point to major systemic problems that maybe, like, oh, maybe that can be fixed in a decade. That'll be fixed in, you know, before I die. But the things that white people in particular can do right now start at home. They start in your offices. They start in the ways you interact with Black people in your everyday life. And so I hope that you should see me in a crown and, you know, any piece of fiction written by and about Black people. I hope that that offers a window into what those microaggressions do to people over the course of their life.
Let's talk about some of the LGBTQ plus portrayals in the book. Were any of those challenging for you to unpack and put on the page?
Yeah. So in a lot of ways, I was growing right alongside Liz as she's coming into her queer identity in the book. I'm coming into my queer identity in real life. The book was a lesson for me in radical honesty. And so that was really, I don't necessarily want to say difficult, but it was a certain type of challenge because I was never an out queer teenager in middle of nowhere, Indiana. That was an experience that I never had and I won't ever have. And so I was trying to channel some of the feelings that I had internalized about shame around my sexuality in my adulthood. I was channeling a lot of those insecurities into Liz because I do think that for a lot of us who come out in our adulthoods, we're still moving through a lot of the things that, you know, regular teenagers, straight teenagers, do when they're 15 years old. And so it wasn't that much of a far cry for me to feel the way I imagine a 16-year-old would have felt in that environment.
Well, Liz sounds really courageous because she is out and proud. And you were not when you were her age, it sounds like. Does any part of you wish you could go back and make that a more visible part of your life at that stage?
You know, that's a really interesting question because I lean into the idea that sexuality is fluid. And so when I was 16, I was not queer. It wasn't that I was closeted. I just was not. That wasn't a thing that I was even, it wasn't a thing that I had even thought about. And maybe if I had had access to more text that showed that it was a possibility, it would have been permission giving in a way, and it would have opened my eyes to more possibilities. But when I was a teenager, I wasn't even thinking about that. It was so far away from me. It wasn't until my adulthood that I was even like, huh, is this a friend, or are these not friend feelings that I'm having for this one? And so, I'm really grateful for the teen years that I had, because even without worrying about being queer, I had a lot of other stuff going on that I was trying to figure out. And so you throw that into the mix, who knows what would have happened?
One of the central characters is Liz's grandmother. Can you talk about their relationship?
Yeah. So Liz is being raised by her grandparents because her mother died when she was a child from sickle cell and from complications related to sickle cell. And now Liz's little brother, Robbie, also has it. And so Liz is constantly thinking about the ways she can protect the people in her life, because she feels as though she couldn't save her mom, so maybe she can save her brother. And she can't, remove the stress from her grandparents from having to raise the two of them. But maybe if she can pay off college, she can, take some of the responsibility off their shoulders. Like, Liz is constantly thinking outwardly, like, what can I do to help alleviate pain and pressure from the people I care about? And Liz's grandma is such an important figure in the story, because she sees how hard Liz is working and just wants to take those burdens off of her. Liz is taking on a lot more than any teenager should have to take on, which is an experience that I understand. It's an experience that I saw reflected in so many of my friends growing up. It's like, we just want to help our families, and so we take on these undue burdens of responsibility, and all of us are in an intricate web of affection. Like, we're all trying to help each other and taking on more than we should and more than we need to. And so Liz's grandma is a figure that exists largely to be like, Liz, you are not alone in this. We have you. And I thought that was really important to show to teenagers.
Hmm. All right. Last word time. Elevator pitch. Don't mean to put you on the spot, but what do you want people to know before they pick up the book?
Yeah, I am on the spot, Matt. I am on the spot. Okay, but we're going to do it.
We're going to do it.
I want people to know that this book is about taking ownership of all of your identities and doing it proudly. And sometimes that journey happens when you're 17. Sometimes that journey happens when you're 24. And sometimes that journey happens when you've already grown up and had your kids or your family or retired or whatever the case may be. Whatever stage in your life that you're at, that you come to this book, I hope that you walk away knowing that you deserve to take up the space you take up.
Leah Johnson is a Central Indiana native and the author of You Should See Me in a Crown, which just came out at the beginning of this month. Leah, thanks for the book and thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our technical director. Our podcast can be found wherever you get podcasts. On Monday, we will talk to a panel of community leaders working to meet the needs of the LGBTQ+ community. In the meantime, we are on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend. This is All In.